Is Luby's, is it a Texas thing only exclusively?
I don't know. I think it may be a Tennessee thing.
Have you been to Luby's?
We had
them
in Arkansas.
Oh, okay. Oh, so really? They're in Arkansas.
Uh-huh. Oh.
So we have confirmation they were in Arkansas as well.
Confirmation right here, right now.
I loved Luby's growing up.
I did too.
It was amazing.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Theology Live. My name is Meredith Day, and I will be taking on the role as host of Theology Live once our dear Reverend Broderick Greer departs. So today, actually, the interviewer will become the interviewee, and we are going to be interviewing, rather, I'm going to be interviewing Broderick Greer. Hi, Broderick. How are you?
I am well, Meredith. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. We are sitting in your office today. It's a lovely Tuesday afternoon.
Monday
afternoon. Clearly, I'm having some trouble this week.
It's been a long week already,
it
probably.
It has, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so glad we're doing this.
Me too.
How does it feel to be on this side of the microphone?
Very intimidating.
Really?
I'm nervous, actually.
Why are you nervous?
Because I'm accustomed to being the one in control.
Oh, Broderick, that says nothing about you.
All of the truth comes all out, finally.
Okay, Broderick. Well, I thought we would start off. I mean, I know a lot about you because we're friends, presumably.
We are definitely friends.
Okay, good. But I thought, you know, I don't know how much you've really shared about your history or who you are while you've been interviewing other folks. I mean, maybe in your Sunday sermons, mm-hmm. right? So tell us about your upbringing. Where did you grow up? Who is your family? Just tell us about all things origin of Broderick Greer.
So I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. My parents never lived more than 5 minutes away from their parents. And so I never lived more than five minutes away from my grandparents.
That's amazing.
Which is awesome. I never had to go to daycare because my grandparents picked me and my brother up from school, or an aunt or a cousin would pick us up. And the only thing I can say about my childhood is that I always felt very safe. I grew up in a very large extended family, a very warm, immediate family. I never needed anything. I never wanted for anything. And that was my childhood. Very warm, very welcoming. My dad was sort of the informal mayor of our block. So he was always outside either barbecuing or doing yard work, and everyone would stop and, you know, want to talk to Mr. Greer. And he was, you know,
he was like basically the Mr. Rogers
exactly
of your block in
yes.
Texas.
And that was very much a defining sort of identity growing up, was that my family was sort of the center of not attention, but of kind of life in my neighborhood. And a lot of younger men who were, of course, older than me, but younger than my dad, really looked up to him, would come to him for advice. He's a wise person. In my dad's neighborhood that he grew up in, he and his oldest brother would do a barbecue every year the week of 4th of July. And about 150 to 200 people would come from the neighborhood, people from my parents' jobs and church and my grandparents' neighborhood. So it's interesting. My family has like this weird tradition of convening people at tables, which is what I do now as a priest.
Oh, that's so great.
And those values have sort of been passed on to me. And I'm just very grateful. My parents are both still living. I'm very close to them and talk to them every day.
Now tell us about, we are also both recovering Southern Baptists,
yes.
which is a growing club in the Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. We're starting to take over. So tell us about your upbringing. I know you also were a part of the Church of Christ for some mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. went to Church of Christ University. So tell us, what was kind of your what was, as Krista Tippett would call, the spiritual landscape of your life? She always asks this question
first. I've
always
wanted to be asked that question.
Oh, my goodness. This is
my only chance.
This is your moment.
I'll never be on Being. My spiritual landscape. So, and I actually have talked about this quite a bit, which is so funny. So I actually didn't grow up Southern Baptist. I grew up Missionary Baptist, which is a part of the National Baptist Convention,
right,
which is a historically black denomination. It's, I think, the largest historically black denomination in the U.S., with the Church of God in Christ being kind of a close second. And my maternal grandmother was the minister of music at the church that I was born and baptized in, Mount Carmel Missionary Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas. And she was there for 40 years, which is just remarkable that she would do that. And she had started playing the piano for churches when she was about 9 years old for Sunday school at her, you know, childhood church in East Texas in the 40s. And, you know, church was just an integral piece of my life. So my mom would corral me and my brother to get us ready for church. We'd get there. Church would have, quote, started at 10:30. I don't know if it ever actually started at 10:30. We would always get there about 11, 11:15. My mom would have to go to the choir stand. My brother and I would be sitting up there with her and the other adults. My grandmother would be at the piano. And I just remember having such a rich theological imagination as a kid. Like when the pastor would tell stories, you know, read gospel stories or read Old Testament stories, Hebrew Bible stories in my childhood, I just remember taking them all so literally.
Yeah.
And, you know, even at times my kind of inner life was so deeply informed by these stories that I would be like, oh, in this situation, like with my brother or with someone at school or whatever, I'm Esau, or I'm, you know, like some people have like comic books that they refer to themselves, you know, like, but mine was these rich biblical stories,
right,
that I thought were literal, you know, that they had just happened. And that
Wait,
they was
aren't?
My, we can get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
And that just so deeply shaped my spiritual life, my spiritual imagination as a child. So since it was a black church, we would be in church from like 10:30. We wouldn't get out until about 1:30. And then we would go to Luby's Cafeteria.
Yes.
Which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Because
the orange Jell-O, though.
How would one say this? The white Christians would arrive at Luby's Cafeteria at about 11:30 or noon.
Sure.
And then the black Christians would arrive at Luby's Cafeteria at about 1:30 or 2 o'clock or 2:30. And we would know if we got out of church early, if we were the first black people to Luby's.
To be at Luby's.
Which is so funny to me now. And so that's where we would be on Sunday afternoon. And then sometimes we would then have a 3:30 service at our church where we would have a visiting congregation come and their pastor would preach and their choir would sing and we'd sing again. And then we might be in church again at 6 o'clock that evening for either someone's musical or, you know, they would have, each department would have their own, what they would call an annual day. So it would be usher's annual day or choir annual day or whatever. So I would sometimes, as a child, be in church at 10:30 to 1:30, 3:30 to, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock, then again from like 6 o'clock till 8. And we were just in church all day long.
That's like more than you're in church as a priest.
Absolutely. Like way more. and that's actually one reason I love the Episcopal Church, is because church is very, very short,
right,
compared to my upbringing. And another thing, and this is another telling piece of my family's makeup and thus of my makeup, we would, if we didn't have 17 services to go to on Sunday, we would go and visit what we call the sick and shut-ins in our church. Mm-hmm. So usually older women, most likely, who either lived in my grandmother's neighborhood or somewhere else, and we would go see them, and I would sing for them as a kid. And that was just a part of my life. And so for me, church was a place of safety. Church was a place of community. And church was a place where I always felt like I belonged.
Yeah. And you're going to sing for us now too, right?
No, not today.
I can't believe I've never heard you sing. It's such a bummer. So did you always know? I mean, so in my upbringing, and I did grow up in church, in the Southern Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I got that wrong earlier. I didn't see women as pastors in front of me, mostly growing up as a child, but I was always this strangely religious kid, sort of what you're talking about, the comic books compared to the Genesis stories of, like, family drama. Mm-hmm. You know, I was baptizing my sisters in the bathtub you know, taking Hawaiian King's Hawaiian rolls and dipping them in grape juice at the dinner table. So I don't think it was too much of a surprise to my parents when I finally said, you know, I think this is what I want to do. So I guess my question for you is, did you always know, I mean, from a young age, that you wanted to build those communities that you're talking about? You felt safe, you felt included and welcomed. Did you know as a young child that you wanted to do the work of building those spaces?
No, I wanted to be a politician. But I knew before I became a politician, I would have to go to law school. So that's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to be president.
Yes.
And I took that very seriously. Even though when I was six, there was a gospel music artist who came to Fort Worth every year to do a workshop, and her name was Margaret DeRoe, and she actually still is living. And she wrote a lot of songs that my grandmother would play and teach us. And when I was 6 years old, she did a workshop at Mount Olive Baptist Church in Fort Worth. And my grandmother took me up to meet Dr. DeRoe. And Dr. DeRoe told me that I had an anointing on my life and that I was going to become a minister.
Wow.
But I was like, I want to be president. So I didn't think about that again.
So you said, never mind.
I was like, oh, well, thank you. And then, you know, we went away.
Wait, how old were you when that
happened? I was six.
You were six?
So first grade, yeah. And I remember vividly because I was there with my grandmother the whole weekend for the workshop. Which is that's like a very 90s Black Baptist thing. Dr. Margaret DeRoe, she's still living. I'm actually Facebook friends with her, and I've relayed this story to her that she, of course, doesn't remember.
Sure.
But I remember because it was very formative. And then from then on, that, you know, older women in my church mainly would always say, well, you know, baby, you have a anointing, you're going to be a minister. Yeah. And I'd be like, I want to be president. I don't want to be a minister.
Move over Barack Obama.
I know. No Barack Obama then.
Roger
you know,
Greer.
Just it was going to be me. Which is also a telling thing about my parents. Like, you know, I didn't know that there were like structural things in place that would prevent me from being president and prevent me from going to Ivy League schools and stuff like that. But my parents, I never knew any different. I was like, they were like, of course you're going to be president. Of course you're going to do whatever you want to do. But when I was about 14, I had become Church of Christ, which is a predominantly white Southern fundamentalist denomination. And I remember being 14 and saying, I'm going to become a minister. First, like, I don't know where that came from.
Where the flip switched.
It may have been puberty. But I then decided somehow that I was going to be a minister. And so I started preaching when I was 16 in the Church of Christ.
Really?
Yeah. And it, yeah.
And how was that received? Do you feel like there were still people in the church that were saying, yes, Broderick, like, you are anointed for this work when you were 16?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of affirmation
in
that faith community for me to be a minister and to pursue that. And I went to a Church of Christ college where I majored in biblical studies for the first few semesters with the intention of being a full-time, what they would call pulpit minister as an adult. And that didn't happen either. I didn't, you know, because I didn't stay Church of Christ. I eventually was confirmed in the Episcopal Church in 2010 at the age of 20. So that seed was planted very early, and it took a while to kind of take hold. And
yeah. Isn't it funny how it seems like people can see our future before we can? I mean, even though in the story that you're telling about, remind me of her name.
Margaret Durow.
Margaret Durow, who was telling you this as a young child. I mean, I feel similarly. There were kind of these moments where people were calling it out for me and in me before I had any real understanding.
And that's the power of community, that much of the time, you know, faith belongs to a community before it belongs to an individual, that vocation might very well belong to a community before it belongs to an individual, which is why we baptize infants in the Episcopal Church, because there is this sense that the faith and the love and the safety of being a part of God's household begins in us and through us before we can even fully understand it with our brains. And that's kind of what the case was for me.
Right. So, I mean, the Canterbury Trail, it doesn't seem that far off for you. Even just talking about your history of a ritualistic kind of family and faith, that the Episcopal Church really kind of fits into that worldview in a lot of ways.
I remember the first time I saw a written prayer. I was about 8 or 9.
Really? Where was it?
It was at a Baptist church in their fellowship hall. And I saw this prayer, and it was a prayer before meals. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know people could write prayers. And I thought that that was just so intriguing. And then in my second year of seminary a few years ago, my mom sent me a copy of a Life magazine that I had bought when I was about 8 or 9. And it was a commemorative edition focusing on John Paul II, the former pope.
Wow.
And so, you know, I had this like preoccupation with like Roman Catholic vestments. And so it's interesting, like when you pay attention to your childhood, how you can often find
These like nuggets.
Those flashes.
You're like, oh, wow, I really did know all along.
Exactly.
In a weird way. Now tell us a little bit more about your movement towards the Episcopal Church. I know that happened for you when you're 20. You're in college at this Church of Christ school, and you find yourself wandering into those red doors to the Episcopal Church. What was it that drew you initially, and what sustains you in the Episcopal Church?
I think what drew me, I was reading at the time, kind of my senior year of high school, freshman year of college, which says a lot about my social life at that time. I mean, I'm not saying this because I'm proud of it. I'm saying it because it's true. I was reading N.T. Wright, who was an Anglican bishop in England. And Anglican is just another way of saying Episcopal. And I was very comfortable in my identity as a Church of Christ person. And his writings, his reflection on sacramental theology and liturgical theology really enriched my life intellectually, spiritually. And so a friend and I ended up finding an Episcopal church about 30 minutes away from where we were in college. And I went there for Ash Wednesday, the Ash Wednesday service. And there was something about it that, you know, kind of lured me, not immediately. It was kind of over a few months and a couple of years. And through a series of conversations with the priest there, who kept saying, Broderick, you're an Episcopalian and you don't know it, I realized that Anglicanism and the Episcopal Church in particular were a good home for me. Anglicanism's focus on the body of embodiment, of our closeness to the ground and openness to science and openness to history and honesty about history, and also an openness to the latest developments in kind of how we're understanding human nature. There isn't a fear of God revealing something new to people in Anglicanism, with a deep, deep, deep rootedness in kind of ancient ritual, in the Eucharist, in the sacraments of the church, in the creeds of the church. So Anglicanism and the Episcopal Church in particular really took a hold of me, and it's why I'm, you know, proud to be a priest in this tradition and find so much joy in serving the people of God in this particular expression of faith. I often tell people I'm not an evangelist of the Episcopal Church. I'm not always trying to sell the Episcopal Church, because I know it doesn't work for everyone. It works for me, and I always tell people the way that I decided to become an Episcopalian is because I had to figure out for myself in what tradition could I best live out my baptism in. So baptized at the age of 8 in Mount Carmel Missionary Baptist Church. Who would have thought? I would have never guessed that I would end up living out my baptismal vows in the Episcopal Church. I didn't even know how to pronounce the word Episcopal as an 8-year-old or an 18-year-old. And so it just made sense for me. It does not make sense for everyone, but it did make sense for me.
Yeah. And do you think, I wonder, would you say if there's any kind of correlation that as you were finding the Episcopal Church and you talked about this openness, I've heard you describe it before. I can't remember who the original author of this quote is, that evangelism in the Episcopal Church is an invitation to mystery. Mm-hmm. You told me that. Who said that?
Yeah, Urban Holmes.
Urban Holmes, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Former dean of Suwannee Seminary. So at the same time as when you're kind of being opened up, as you say, do you feel like your draw to the Episcopal Church, that other things were opening up in you as well?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, is that the time when you were, you know, coming out as a gay man, mm-hmm. That you are coming to terms with this calling, perhaps, to be a priest? I mean, what other things were opening up?
Yeah, it was all happening at the same time.
Right.
You know, I was basically beginning to come out about age 18 and age 19 without knowing that the Episcopal Church, to some extent and to a good extent, welcomes the gifts and ministry of lay and ordained of LGBTQ people. I discovered this, you know, kind of in the midst of that journey toward Canterbury, if you want to call it that, or, you know, whatever. My journey into the Episcopal Church. And so this kind of identity as a gay person, this identity as a person of faith, this identity as a Black person, for once in my life, was able to be integrated, and I was able to be whole before God, before myself, before my family, before the church, which had just never been the case. I'd always, up until that point, lived a very fragmented life, compartmentalized. And what's an interesting aside to all of that, I say I was baptized at age 8, which is true, but I actually ended up being baptized 4 times because I thought, oh, well, I'm going to wash away the gay. You know, some people think they'll pray away the gay. I thought I would wash it away. It didn't come off, I can tell you that. And I realized either I'm going to fight who I am. I'm going to fight, you know, God's giftedness to me in my own experience in my own life. Or I will surrender to love, and I will surrender to mystery. And this is around the time I was confirmed in the Episcopal Church. And oftentimes, those sacramental markings or sacramental rites like confirmation, reaffirmation of baptismal vows, reception into the church, oftentimes those things happen and coincide with, you know, what the Celtic mystics would call a thin place in your life, a time when you're vulnerable, you're open to the spirit, you're open to a transition. And so my own coming out and my confirmation really linked in a beautiful way, and something that I'm intensely grateful for.
That's so beautiful, Broderick. Mm-hmm. It does. It makes me think about that, you know, the mystics would say that the journey or the path to knowing God is a parallel path to knowing yourself.
Absolutely.
That as we know God, we end up befriending ourselves too.
Yeah,
in a lot
and
of
I
ways.
Would often, I mean, and I know that this is cliche, but I would even refer to my own quote coming out process. I think that's kind of a weak term for myself. I don't really know what else to say other than that, though. My own coming out process was in its own way a conversion process, where I had to realize that there really truly wasn't anything I could do that would make God either love me less than God loved me or make God stop loving me altogether. There was nothing.
Right.
And I had been told that growing up, but I didn't believe that in my heart or in my life. And so that experience of realizing that the unnatural thing is not homosexuality. The unnatural thing is heterosexism. You know, the unnatural thing isn't a healthy sexual identity or gender identity or sexual orientation. The unhealthy thing is the oppression of people based on their sexual identity, gender identity, or sexual orientation. And so that realization for me was almost a spiritual experience, that the thing that had been kind of the source of my shame, my guilt, my sense of alienation from God was actually the vehicle to my wholeness and what my evangelical friends would call my salvation.
Right, right.
So.
It is so often the case, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
The stumbling block becomes the cornerstone.
Yeah, and St. Paul would say that, you know, he kept asking the Lord to remove this
thorn
in the flesh. And finally, Jesus is exasperated with St. Paul, and he appears to him in a dream, and he says, stop trying to remove this thorn in the flesh. My grace is sufficient for you. You know, my power is made known in your weakness. And that is definitely a parallel kind of experience of my life with God.
Sure. So I wanted to ask you, I know our time is probably kind of coming to an end, but you've been doing this podcast, Theology Live, for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it feels to be like handing over your baby. I'm sure it's a very weird feeling. But I would love if you would just reflect a little bit on the last 2 years, what this experience has kind of meant to you. Are there any moments or episodes that stand out to you as kind of, you know, mile markers or moments that were really important in your own journey as a priest? Just tell us, what has it been like doing this and being the interviewer for so long?
It has been the joy of these 2 years. I think it's been fun watching our space, and it had already been this way. I mean, Theology Live is kind of the second iteration of a program that started about 4 years earlier called This Rounds on Me, which was a kind of a version of Theology on Tap. I don't know if anyone remembers when people were really doing that in 2010, 2011.
Right.
And, you know, when I got here to Grace St. Luke's, I changed the name and added the podcast feature, and it's awesome. And it has always been awesome in its own way. But I think it had always been a safe space for doubt and for questions. And what we also tried to add to that, you know, kind of deconstruction of theology was something beautiful in its place, or something beautiful in addition to what was already there. So we had all of these constructive theologians who would come, like Dr. Ebony Marshall Turman or Dr. Emily Holmes, my friend Pastor Verzola Law, people of deep faith and a deep comfort with doubt, with a lack of clarity. You know, I know my life, so much of my life has been spent in kind of the gray area spiritually.
Right.
Where, you know, either feeling estranged from God, estranged from myself. And there have been these flashes and these moments of great clarity and great love and deep joy. But I think the majority of people that I know, at least, and that I pastor and that I'm in relationship with, live in that gray. And if the church writ large, big C church, Catholic, Protestant, Anabaptist, whatever, doesn't have the courage and the wherewithal to live in that gray with people, it has no moral credibility. And really, in addition to that, if the church cannot ask kind of the most pressing questions of meaning, of beauty, of social wholeness, of eliminating white supremacy, of eliminating racism and sexism, trans antagonism, if the church isn't about asking those pressing questions, not necessarily with the intention of finding an answer, but at least asking the question, taking the risk
right.
of the quest, then we are lacking in our moral credibility. And so I have sought in these 2 years, you know, short 2 years, to help facilitate, and I'm not the first person to do this. People have been doing this for ages. Christians have been asking great questions for a long time, but I have sought to facilitate a space in which people are okay with there not being a clear answer. I think about our reproductive justice episode back in March with Faye London. And I had a number of people come to me and say, oh, I'm so excited, you know, to really, I'm going to bring my notebook and Faye is going to tell me how I talk to my fundamentalist grandmother about abortion. And she's going to show me.
Order.
Yeah, that's a tall order. They're going to she's going to have the Bible and take me to the verse so that, you know, at Thanksgiving, I can talk to Granny.
Why
and I don't
no.
know, but you know how people are. I'm going to go to Thanksgiving and talk to Granny about abortion and why there's a biblical case for being pro-choice and for supporting the autonomy of people who have uteruses to make decisions about their bodies.
Right.
But Faye came and did the opposite. You know, she brought up this beautiful story from Exodus 1, end of Exodus 1, beginning of Exodus 2, of what Walter Brueggemann would call the first labor union in the Bible. And it's this group of Hebrew midwives who make the decision that they're not going to commit genocide on their sons at the, you know, order of Pharaoh.
Right.
And that's kind of the first show of reproductive justice in the Bible, according to Faye London, which I think is a great reading of that story.
Right.
And what she did, she didn't tell us how to think. You know, she respected us as adults and said, you can make your own conclusions, but this is what I'm going to offer you, is this rich biblical imagination, this rich theological imagination around this issue. And I hope I've done the same, offered people a rich the rich space that they need to think and to pray, to imagine a better world, to imagine a better self, and to imagine beyond all odds that they are loved, they are valued by God, and there's nothing that they or anyone can do to change it.
Yes. That's all I have to say to that. Yes, period. It's so good. Oh, Broderick, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Oh, it's been a joy. And I know that you're going to be a great host.
Oh,
Meredith won't
kind.
Say this herself, but she has a Master's of Divinity from Yale Divinity School. And she has studied with some of the smartest people in theology in our country and in our world, and knows many, many intelligent and thoughtful people and wise people. And she brings this wisdom to this podcast. It's going to be completely different from me, which I'm excited to listen in the future and hear the direction that it takes. It's beyond exciting. I mean, it's like, you know, how I'm not a parent, but I've heard some parents who have preschoolers, like you take your kid to the first day of preschool and you expect it to be this extremely emotional, like, oh, I'm going to cry and my kid's going to cry and they're going to hold on to my leg. And then the kid's like, bye, see you later. Pick me up at 3:45 aftercare. And they're okay. And they're safe. And they're in the right place. And they need you, but they also don't. And that's how I feel about this podcast. It's my preschooler. She's going to school. She's happy without me. And it's going to be awesome.
Oh.
It's probably the worst analogy ever.
No, it's really good.
I try to never bring up analogies because I am an analogy just murderer.
That is not true. We are so grateful for you. And Broderick, thank you for devoting so much of your time and so much of yourself over the last 2 years to this podcast. It has truly been a gift to me, just even as an outsider and someone who's been here for a limited amount of time. But I know, especially to those folks who've been in Memphis, I mean, you have made this parish better. You have made this city better, and it will deeply, deeply miss your presence.
And I will miss everyone here. And it's so funny. I thought, because we took this turn probably the second season, and started basically inviting majority women. Most of our guests are women. A large number of our guests are people of color. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, no one's going to come. Like, no one's going to come because they're going to be like, this is a black podcast now. And that's okay. It's worked.
Yeah.
Because people are hungry for good scholarship, for accessible scholarship, for rich conversations. So I think when you're creating something and you're afraid that your taste or your lived experience won't resonate with someone, you know, that's faulty thinking.
Yeah.
Just do it. Be bold. Take the risk. Do the thing. Create that beautiful thing that's in your heart. And it will resonate. It will land well. And we will all be better for it.
Yes. Oh, Broderick, we're just so grateful to have you. Oh, my goodness. I can't wait to come visit you in Denver.
Come see me.
I will come and see you. I want to thank everybody who's listening to the podcast today. Thank you for joining us on this special edition of Theology Live. Special thanks also to Noah, our sound engineer, who's with us today. And again, a very, very, very special thanks to the Reverend Broderick Greer, who has been with us for 2 years and who will now be making his way off to Denver in a couple of weeks here. So thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us in October for our next gathering. Bye.